Welcome to Tell Somebody here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is Mike Murphy filling in for Tom Clammer. We've got a special program for you today, though I'd like to think every edition of Tell Somebody is a special program. We've got Dr. Jill Stein with us today. Dr. Stein was the Green Party's 2012 presidential candidate. And she is also vying for the 2016 nomination as well. And this is going to be a call-in show. So if you have questions you'd like to ask Dr. Stein, we've got Larry J. screening calls. The number to call is 816-931-5534. But that being said, welcome, Dr. Stein.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. So let's go over, do a little Jill Stein 101 for listeners who may not be familiar with you. First of all, you are a physician, is that correct?
That's right, yes. I am a medical doctor by training and by about 35 years worth of practice, and now I say I'm practicing political medicine because it's the mother of all illnesses. And we've got to fix this one before we fix everything else that's literally killing us.
Yeah, good point. So what got you into, what way made you make that transition?
Yeah, you know, it was basically coming to realize that my, you know, my commitment to health, basically, you know, was, you know, that there's more to it than going to the office and giving people pills and procedures. And I became very frustrated doing that and pushing people back out to the things that were making them sick. And I have to say that when I went into practice, you know, some 35 years ago, we were just at that time beginning to see these epidemics of asthma and cancer and learning disabilities and attention deficit disorder and things like that. And I said to myself, where's this coming from? Our genes didn't change overnight. What's going on here? So I became involved with groups, Physicians for Social Responsibility and other groups, looking at what were the drivers here. It became very clear that there were policy things we could do to clean up the air, to improve our food supply, to address the stresses of poverty and homelessness and things like that. And you know, I then went into a 10-20 year career of being an advocate as well as a healthcare provider, and began to really clearly see how the political system stands in the way of addressing root causes of, you know, of health issues. And to make a long story short, I became part of a coalition to get money out of politics. And we actually passed a referendum in my home state to do that, a clean elections bill that provided public financing. And after we passed it, the Democratic Party, which controlled the legislature by a huge majority, repealed it, not wanting to have the competition. And that was kind of a heads up to me that this was a fundamentally political problem, and we had to fix our political system if we were going to fix all the other things that, you know, are literally killing us, literally and figuratively, whether it's our economy or our health and so on, and that it wasn't going to happen inside the Democratic Party. That, in a nutshell, is how I got to be recruited for the first time, and I would say more tricked, into running for office for the first time in 2002, and discovered that there's a wonderful conversation that is begging to be held, and the public is really hungry for real people and a real politics that's not bought and paid for by, you know, the big special interests and fossil fuel companies and health insurance companies and all that, and that the public is perfectly capable of smelling a rat and is very hungry for everyday people out there to be a part of the political process and to give everyday people a voice in this politics, which we are generally denied through our very sold-out and corrupt political system.
So you mentioned your home state. What is your home state?
I'm sorry, Massachusetts.
And so that's where you first ran for office in Massachusetts.
Yes. And in fact, I ran for governor of Massachusetts. I was recruited to run, as I say, refer to it, you know, not altogether jokingly, that I was sort of tricked into running, having no idea what it really meant to run, particularly to run for higher office. I was running for governor as my first race and had not been a political animal at all before that, you know, really did not have enough faith in the political process and the big parties that are evident to most people. But then I got recruited by the Green Party and discovered this was a whole new kind of politics that was just about everyday people and wasn't manipulated by, big guys in back rooms. And I ran out of desperation because it was clear that doing everything else through the normal advocacy channels, it was clear that it was a really money-controlled process, and then when we tried to control the money, we got totally slapped down, you know, that we really needed to challenge the system. And when I did that, we actually fought our way into a debate because people were so horrified by the new form of torture that we call political debates with just the two parties. We fought our way in. I got into a televised debate, and in that debate, the ideas that I put forward, for health care as a human right and the right to education and the need to cut our military and put our dollars into true security here at home, the green the economy, things like that, went over like lead balloons inside the debate hall, which was a TV studio. But when we walked out, I was mobbed by the press who told me that I won the debate on the instant online viewer poll. And that was a moment of such revelation to me to see that these basic ideas for people, planet, and peace that we are told are the fringe are actually the core of American values and community values and what people truly support. And for me, that was a real wake-up moment that this sort of public interest agenda is actually what the public is hungering for. And it gave me, you know, enormous commitment, I must say, to continuing to follow that lead so that we could elevate this basic agenda to address our needs for democracy and justice and for a world that works for all of us, to elevate that into public discourse and actually, you know, to challenge power, because they're taking us in a very, what shall we say, you know, an absolutely unsustainable direction right now, which is very hurtful to the people and the planet and our prospects for survival. So, you know, I think it's a very exciting moment right now because the crisis is hitting home and people are very hungry for a different way forward.
So, before we leave Massachusetts, tell us who you were running against.
At the time, I was running against Mitt Romney, who was the Republican candidate for governor, and against the Democratic Party state treasurer, a woman named Shannon O'Brien, and there was also a Libertarian and Independent in that race as well.
And were the Libertarian and Independents in the debate as well?
They were. Yes, they were.
Wow.
But they, you know, they were not particularly, what shall I say, they weren't doing really well in the polling. I can't tell you exactly where they landed, but they were not, you know, they were not in the top numbers. So it was really, it was a progressive agenda. It wasn't simply being being a rebel outside of the two corrupt political parties. It was also that I was clearly articulating a progressive agenda that was being validated in that instant online viewer poll. And truth to tell, that's usually the case. When Greens are able to get to the microphone and get into debates, we typically do win them. And I would say the same is often true for, you know, people like Shama Sawant, who won the city council seat in Seattle, and who is a socialist, and who is standing up for the things that everyday people need. This is why the system works so hard not to have debates and to lock people out. And I should mention, Mike, we have a legal case that has been filed in federal court suing to open up the presidential debates, the final debates before the general election, that people have a right to hear from more than just the Democratic and Republican parties.
I don't know if you heard this. Martin O'Malley was on Democracy Now! This morning, and he's actually calling for protests against the Democratic Party because they're only going to have four debates, and he thinks that's kind of designed to protect the favorite candidate, which would be Hillary Clinton. Any thoughts on that?
And this is what the Democratic Party does. It rigs the process inside the Democratic Party, and it seeks to rig the process of debate and discussion in the broader election. And that same iron fist that is fighting real debate and discussion inside the Democratic Party that Martin O'Malley is complaining about, that same control has been exerted by the Democratic Party together with the Republican Party, and the two of them took over the institution of presidential debates in the 1980s. And it was at that time that this so-called Commission on Presidential Debates was established. It's a nice official-sounding title. It sounds like it's a public institution, but it's not. It's controlled by the Democratic and Republican parties, who are in agreement not to allow any candidates other than their own. And they're actually violating federal law. Fortunately, there is a federal law here that requires that these federal debates be nonpartisan, not bipartisan, nonpartisan. So they need to be open to other voices. And current polls show that 50% of Americans do not consider themselves to be a part of the Democratic or Republican parties. So is it fair to lock out 50% of Americans from these debates? It's certainly not. And that's the same thing, you know, that I think Martin O'Malley is protesting inside of the Democratic Party.
So what you're saying is that basically the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are working hand in glove to keep out any perceived threats from either side, whether they be like constitutionalist or libertarian from the right or green or socialist or something from the left.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. And in fact, the debates used to be run by the League of Women Voters. And when the Democratic and Republican parties sort of took over, basically what happened is that they refused to participate unless they could control the debates. And that meant controlling the criteria for getting in. It meant controlling who the questioner was going to be. They needed a questioner who would be friendly to those two parties and to their candidates. They wanted to control what press would be allowed in. They wanted to control who would be in the audience so that you could basically stack an audience to show that there's support for these, you know, oligarchy candidates, the candidates of the 1%. They stack the audience so that it has the appearance of having support when, in fact, it doesn't, except to the degree that they manipulate it and propagandize it and control it. So at the time the League of Women Voters quit, they said that this was basically a fraud being perpetrated on the American voter, and they were not going to be a party to it. And that is, you know, that's, I think that's as good a description as any of this presidential process and really what our whole political system has become, a fraud being perpetrated on the American voter. And, you know, it's quite a challenge to break into that. But one of the ways that we can break into that is by having open debates.
So
once you begin to open up the discussion, then all kinds of other things become possible.
So when you say open debates, maybe elaborate a little on that.
Yes. So what that means is that candidates who could actually win the election, that is, they are organized, they have a base of support, they've done the work such that they are on the ballot for the majority of voters and therefore could win the race, that needs to be a criteria. There are you know, a lot of people who are running for president. And if you simply included everyone who filed with the Federal Election Commission as a presidential candidate, that would be way too many to have in a debate. So it turns out if you were using this criteria of candidates who, you know, met the federal requirement to run, that means, you know, U.S. born, you need to be of age, 35 or more, and you have to meet that criteria, plus you would have to be on the ballot for the majority of voters, it would typically have been about four or five candidates, and on one occasion seven, but usually about five, that would have qualified over the past many decades. So we're not talking about, you know, the 16 or 17 that the Republicans are accommodating. No, we're talking about the leading candidates who have true bases of support such that they are actually on the ballot. And that would basically mean a Democrat, a Republican, a Green, a Libertarian, and perhaps an Independent.
So are you suggesting using things like I've heard thrown around in the past, the use of like, well, it all depends on how much money you raise or how you're doing in the polls. Like, is those type of criteria would factor in, or?
Actually, what we're proposing is that, you know, basically what I just described, that it be limited to candidates who are actually qualified, that is, qualified by appearing on the ballot of more than half voters. Once, and that alone would limit the number to four to five candidates and create a diversity of viewpoints representing the most supported viewpoints. Once you start setting polling thresholds, you know, that is possible, but there are a variety of issues that come up with polling that the Republicans have been, you know, have had a lot of controversy about as well. That would be reasonable to take the four or five leading contenders in a poll. That would be a possibility as well, you know, once you've sorted down to your nominees and you're down into the general phase of the election. That would be another way that you could do it. But you want it to be people who are on the ballot, for example.
Right.
So that limits your pool right there. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for allowing diverse points of view to be heard and not depending on money. You know, I think money is the problem. You don't want to introduce another money requirement that basically eliminates everyday people and their voices from the process.
Right. So while we're on the subject of debates, maybe you can share with our listeners a little bit about Jill Stein's adventures in debates from like 2012. And before you go into that, I do want to remind our listeners that you're welcome to call in and ask Dr. Stein a question yourself. The number is 816-931-5534. Go ahead, Dr. Stein.
So, you know, as I mentioned back in the first race that I ran in, there were huge protests against these debates because people felt like they did not include everyday people, you know, the voices of everyday people by just having Mitt Romney and the state Democratic Party treasurer. So people were really pushing for open debates. Typically, this is a cause that is very near and dear to the hearts of everyday Americans. Even when people support a Democrat and a Republican, most of the time people want a truly meaningful and vigorous debate. They want to hear other points of view. And so we were able to fight our way into the debates in 2012. Back in the year 2002 when I first ran. And we did that subsequently in other runs that I've had in Massachusetts. In 2012, my running mate, Sherry Honkala, and myself went to attend a debate, simply to listen to a debate. And we were arrested just trying to get into the campus where the debate was being held. We were arrested and taken handcuffed to a secret dark site that had been set up in advance for, you know, for political unrest at the debates. And we were taken to this dark site, which was not, you know, nobody knew where it was. It was not a police station. This was a unknown secret site where there were about 16 police and Secret Service agents that basically stood around and watched us for about 7 hours while we were chained, handcuffed tightly, I should say, to these metal chairs for the duration. And then when all the crowds and the press had gone home, we were basically sent out, you know, into the street with no cell phones, no money, you know, no nothing, you know, out into the streets in on a cold Long Island night, and sort of had to beg our way to make a phone call to get back to our staff, who had no idea where we were. Well, actually, there's a longer story to that. They had been able to figure out by asking emergency medical technicians, you know, were there any places that, you know, that that the police might secretly be using? So through various pathways, the staff had been able to track down where we were, but they were told that if they stayed on site, they would be arrested if they were anywhere in the vicinity. So at any rate, when we were discharged, we had no way of contacting them. You know, until we found a very kind gas station owner who was closing and agreed to keep the gas station open so we could call our staff and, you know, and get picked up. But yeah, I mean, that's our history with debates. And I think it shows how scared the establishment is that they had to keep us under lock and key, hidden away, and that we couldn't even be at the debate. And we had to be rendered invisible in a setting where there were a lot of press around that could have gotten wind that people have another choice, because people have to be kind of bludgeoned into voting for these, you know, these one percenter candidates who have done such a terrible job of, you know, of leading the country and who have been throwing everyday people under the bus in terms of our economy, our health care, our education system, our foreign policy. You know, things are going to hell in a handbasket here, and people are you know, fighting angry to have other choices and other voices. So, you know, that's where we've been. And contrast that with the debate that I was able to win, you know, in an instant online viewer poll in my first race. It really does say, I think, what a potentially powerful tool debates can be.
Okay, we do have a caller on the line, Dr. Stein. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, Mike and Jill. This is Dave Kingsley calling.
Hey. Dave King, was that? Dave Kingsley?
Yeah, this is Dave.
Hi. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Jill. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
I have a question for Dr. Stein.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be a fair thing to say we will include parties in the debate that have a legitimate political infrastructure? In other words, we have a party, we're on the ballot, and it seems to me that if we had parties like the Greens, the Libertarians, the Independent Party, in fact, Kansas does have several parties on the mm-hmm. ballot. So wouldn't those parties all have a legitimate right to be in the debates?
I think that's a great way to put it. And if you are speaking at the state level or the local level, where this is also an issue, a burning issue, the right to open and inclusive debates, that would be a very good way to define it. And I think you're putting in different words the same principle that we are also articulating. And another way to say a true infrastructure and a true and legitimate infrastructure is to focus on the outcome of that infrastructure, which is basically enough support, you know, credibility, apparatus, et cetera, that you have gotten yourself on the ballot for a majority of voters in that election. Well, that is of having a legitimate and sufficient infrastructure. If you don't have that infrastructure, you can't get on the ballot. It takes that infrastructure to get on the ballot. And in a national election, it takes a lot of national infrastructure to do it. You have to basically be on the ballot for a majority of voters, and that means you need to get on the ballot in a lot of states. So, yes, I think that's another way to say this, because, you know, there are shades of gray of legitimate infrastructure, but one way to define what is that margin of legitimate infrastructure is that it has enabled you to actually go through the process and get on the ballot for a majority of voters. It's a way to also say that the debate then is very relevant to the voters, because those voters then are looking at candidates who actually have, you know, the potential to be true contenders in the race. If they're not on the ballot for the majority of voters, then they're actually not real contenders.
Did you have
I want to say thank you for answering that question, and I guess I would just sign off with this question. It's important for us in the progressive movement to get out and work to get the signatures, to get on the ballots, to begin to build a national political party, although we have one. But I just was wondering if that isn't the primary focus we should have right now, is let's build a party. So with that, I'll just get off the air. Thank you very much, Jill.
Thank you, Dave. I look forward to being in touch. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dave.
Okay. Bye-bye.
In response to that question, I think Dave is exactly right on. Creating that party of everyday people, I think, is critical. And diversity of viewpoints is part of democracy. So, you know, we should have a lot of parties. People should have choices. It's very difficult to fight these battles in the U.S. because of our political system, because we have this winner-take-all form of elections. Unlike most modern democracies now, they have a different kind of voting system that allows many parties to have voices. So in other words, you don't have to win, say, for legislature. You don't have to win the majority of votes. If you get 15% of the votes, then you have a voice. You don't have as many candidates as the party that wins 50%, but you have some. So it becomes a more diverse and representative discussion, and there are some simple ways to do that. But Dave's point is exactly right. We have to start building those alternatives right now, and the Green Party is one of those well-established alternatives, and the current struggle is to get on the ballot in enough states. The rules of getting on the ballot are very biased towards, towards the guys that are already on and the parties that are well-known. If you're a newcomer party or an up-and-coming party, if you are not grandfathered in, you have to run through all kinds of hoops to get on the ballot. And we're in the process of doing that now. And in the last race, we were on the ballot for 85% of voters. And this time, we hope to be on the ballot for 100% of voters. But it means getting organized now to make sure that we collect the signatures. These require petitions in each state. And Dave is exactly right. This process is going on now across the country, and this is a great time to get in touch. You can do that through our website, which is jill2016.com. You can sign up on our volunteer page and let us know if you are interested in this process of getting on the ballot so that we do have choices.
Okay, that's great. And if you'd like to join the conversation with Dr. Jill Stein, Dr. Jill Stein was the Green Party's 2012 presidential candidate and is currently vying to be the 2016 nominee. you can call 816-931-5534. We'd love to get you on the phone and have you ask Dr. Stein a question. And we do have another caller. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name and what part of town are you calling from?
My name is Rich. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, hi. Dr. Stein, if you were to try to do what we used to call an executive summary of your candidacy, without regard to the question of getting on the ballot,
sure.
But in terms of issues, could you do that for us, please?
Sure, yes, and thank you for getting down to that, because that really is the heart of the matter here. And I think that is what brings people to the polls and gets people engaged with the process, is sort of what are your basic ideas, what's your agenda. So just to frame this, my basic idea here is that we are in a very serious situation now, that we are in a crisis, an economic crisis, a climate crisis, a crisis in our foreign policy, in which things are not getting better. They're actually getting worse. Economically, we have a recovery for the fortunate few, but for those who are not so fortunate, which is the vast majority, things are not getting better. In fact, wages have gone down since the recovery began. The jobs that are being created are low-wage, part-time, and temporary. You have 40 million young people who are in debt going to college. Those who don't go to college face staggering sky-high rates of unemployment, 30%. For Caucasians, 50% for African Americans. Meanwhile, banks are bigger than ever. Corporate profits have skyrocketed, CEO compensation and so on, and the gains are going to the top 1%. Same thing in the climate, that we have each year we're setting more records on floods, droughts, storms, and fires. California has 1 year of surface water, yet California produces half of our fruits and vegetables. Jim Hansen, the foremost climate scientist, has just predicted that we're going to see massive rise in sea level in the next couple of decades. We're looking at the breakup now of some major ice sheets, that is in the West Antarctic and potentially Greenland as well. And he's predicting that this is going to happen within a matter of decades, and that we're going to be looking at 10 feet and more of sea level rise, which is going to be, game over for coastal cities and far worse. So my point is that we need to deal with actually the reality that is, and we need to fix it because this is eminently fixable. We're proposing a Green New Deal to basically put 20 million Americans to work in living wage jobs that will transition us on an emergency basis to a green economy. This is like the New Deal of the 1930s that responded to the economic emergency. This would be a response to both our continuing and growing economic problems as well as the climate crisis. It would bring us to 100% clean renewable energy by 2030. Related to that, we're calling for student debt relief. We bailed out the bankers who caused the crisis to the tune of $17 trillion. We can bail out the students and provide public education, that is public higher education, for free. We've done this before in the GI Bill. It's an investment that pays for itself many times over. And we can provide health care as a human right through Medicare for All, which basically restores Medicare in the ways that it's been privatized and degraded. It restores Medicare, which people have loved, and basically drops the age of eligibility. So this is a very simple administrative fix, and it saves us about $400 billion a year. Even while it covers everyone, it saves us an enormous amount of money. So this is the basic, in a nutshell, those are really the most critical propositions of our campaign, what we call our Power to the People agenda. It restores what we need as people and what we need as a planet to have a nation and a world that's working for all of us.
Well, can I ask a question related to what you just said?
Sure.
Payment-wise, where would the money come for these, admittedly, very fine ideas? And related to that, in other words, would they be private sector? Would they be federal sector? And would they be deficit financed or tax financed?
Great. These are great questions, Rich.
How would you weaken the corporate control of what happens in every?
Yes. Let me speak to both of those because those are both really important questions. So about the finance, what's amazing here is that these. Are you still with me? I just had a funny interference there.
Yeah,
am I still connected?
You're still connected. I think he
okay,
hung
great.
Up.
Sorry
to,
about that.
Listen, that's fine.
These reforms actually are self-funded. They may need some advance, priming of the pump, but they pay for themselves in short order. So on the issue of public higher education, we know from the GI Bill it pays for itself actually seven times over. There's a startup cost here, obviously, while that first batch of students is going through. There's a startup cost of about $60 billion a year, which could be paid for example, by having a small tax on Wall Street. Wall Street is the only economic sector, virtually the only economic sector, that doesn't pay a sales tax. And there's a strong argument that this is long overdue, that Wall Street needs to pay a sales tax by putting, everyday people are paying on most items a 5, 6, 7, 8% sales tax. So if Wall Street did its part of only even a 0.1% sales tax, that would generate hundreds of billions of dollars, more than enough to pay for the startup cost of public higher education. Medicare for All pays for itself immediately because there is so much savings by eliminating the massive private health insurance bureaucracy, which we now pay for on every healthcare dollar. Basically, every healthcare dollar, about 20% of it is a tax right now that goes to the bureaucracy, the private healthcare bureaucracy. So by simplifying that, in Medicare, those costs are about 2 to 3%. So that savings alone, when you streamline the administration, which is something that the private sector always says that they do, but doesn't always happen, and healthcare is a good example of where it doesn't happen. So there is such an enormous savings in Medicare for All that pays for itself pretty much with the stroke of a pen. The costs of the Green New Deal are also largely self-paid, though there is some startup here. And the savings here comes in a surprising area, and that is in terms of health. This has been shown in the field in a real-life experiment, as well as through all sorts of studies that show when you clean up the air supply, when you prevent pollution, you're actually preventing all kinds of heart attacks and strokes and asthma and emphysema and diabetes and all kinds of things that are linked to the pollution of fossil fuels. We pay so much for that simply moving to a clean air energy system, the return on your health care costs is so enormous, it actually pays the costs of transitioning to clean energy. And when you add in the other changes that go with the green economy, meaning a healthy green food system with local and sustainable agriculture, and a public transportation system that includes biking and walking and makes it possible and safe to walk and bike to transit hubs, you begin to have a population that is well-nourished, well-exercised, and is not subject to pollution and contamination. And the savings from that are so enormous as to basically pay the costs of the Green New Deal. another cost savings of the Green New Deal is that it makes wars for oil obsolete. We don't have to safeguard either oil or gas sources. Safeguard is one word. Some people, you know, would use other words to describe that. It's not our oil. It's not our gas. You know, it's these are very corrupt systems that we install, like in Saudi Arabia, for example, you know, to maintain, or in Iraq, to maintain our oil supplies. And, you know, we go to war for that oil, not uncommonly. So it's both the resources as well as the transit routes that our military is, you know, largely engaged in protecting. So needing to have this worldwide empire to protect fossil fuel resources is a very expensive proposition. The war in Iraq and Afghanistan cost us about $5 trillion. So, you know, these are absolutely unsustainable costs. Not to mention their human costs as well. 1 million people dead in Iraq. That doesn't do well for our, you know, foreign policy stance and America's standing in public opinion around the world. So there are all kinds of reasons why we need to bring these wars for oil to an end. And by attaining 100% clean renewable energy on an emergency basis, which is what we're calling for, achieving that 100% by 2030, that too is an enormous cost savings. And I can put some ballpark numbers on this if you would like, but we are talking, you know, in terms of military savings of hundreds of billions of dollars a year, in terms of health savings, likewise hundreds of billions of dollars every year. Such that this is more than enough, far more than enough, to pay the startup costs and the, you know, the transitional costs of these programs.
Hmm. Dr. Stein, we're going to take our break and play a couple of messages. My name's Mike Murphy, filling in for Tom Clammer on Tell Somebody. This hour is rapidly flying by, but there's still some time to get in on the conversation and talk to Dr. Stein. The number is 816-931-5534. And we'll be right back after these messages with Dr. Jill Stein.
Supporting KKFI, The Pitches, Crafts, and Drafts. Are you crafty? The Pitch is now accepting applications for vendors at Crafts and Drafts on November 7th at the Uptown Shops. Crafts and Drafts will showcase over 100 local vendors in time to kick off the holiday season. A link to the application is available on the homepage of pitch.com through September 1st. Crafts and Drafts also features food trucks and over 25 beers from local breweries. For more info, pitch.com or call 816-561-6061.
I believe.
Kelly Hunt live in concert, September 11th, 7:30 p.m. in the Polsky Theater at Johnson County Community College. Tickets on sale now at kkfi.org/events.
My glory days, my glory days.
Kelly Hunt, supporting community radio with a benefit concert for 90.1 FM, KKFI.
You're supposed to be.
Congratulations, KKFI listeners. Mountain Sprout, not a planet. My brothers and sisters, Katie Guillen and the girls, and Sarah Morgan are all playing at the Crossroads Music Fest, presented by Sprint, on September 12th. Tickets are on sale right now at cmfkc.com. Saturday, September 12th at 6 p.m., 35 bands on 7 stages. Also, Lauren Anderson, She's a Keeper, The Philistines, Duncan Burnett and the Ministry, Light Music, The Free Years, Willie Arthur Smith's Marching Cobras, with support from the Neighborhood Terrace Development Fund. Crossroads Music Fest, Saturday, September 12th. All information and tickets at cmfkc.com.
And here we are back in the studio. This is Tell Somebody. Mike Murphy filling in for Tom Clammer. And we have Dr. Jill Stein on the phone. And we also have another caller on the phone. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
I'm Charles. I'm calling from the Tulsa area. I listen on the internet.
Oh, great.
Hi, Charles.
All right. I want to thank you, but I really am concerned. You know, what can I do as just a little person? I mean, like, if a few million of us would send in $30, we could have some hope to getting some press and getting some attention and getting you in office. What can we do?
Thank you. Thank you, Charles, so much. So what you can do, let me say that there are so many of us out there, you know, who are hurting for a real voice that represents us, you know, that's not throwing us under the bus as sacrificial lambs like we have been. We have enormous power when you put us together. And let me give you one example of that. There are 40 million young people who are in debt. If word gets out that they can cancel that debt by coming out to vote in the polls, that will be more powerful than all the political advertising that you can buy on TV. So we have tools through guerrilla media, through the internet, through Facebook. We have tools that can create a very powerful force.
Anything you can do to help us drill down to just to
yes,
specifics.
Yes, exactly.
Say, okay,
what I would like you to
do
is to go to our
it.
Website, which is jill2016.com, and if you fill out the volunteer form, we are in the process of beginning to organize the volunteers now, doing things like... So if there's a Green Party, you're in Oklahoma, is that right? You're in Tulsa?
Right.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if the Green Party is active in Oklahoma. So
yeah.
There may or may not be a group to connect you with, but we are starting to organize volunteers anyhow. And we can do this whether people are working locally or whether we're working virtually. Because nowadays we can organize volunteers, for example, to make phone calls, to do phone banking. We can get people to come out and help get on the ballot. I think there's going to be a ballot drive in Oklahoma, so just getting on the ballot in Oklahoma would be fabulous. But we'll be doing all that organizing through our website. There are many things we can do. We can plug you into collecting signatures. If you have connections with colleges, we are in the process of setting up our campus organizing groups now called Young Greens Rising. And you can believe that young people are fighting angry about this. And boy, do they get mobilized when they hear that there is a way to address this hammer of, you know, of debt and the cost of education. We have a generation that's chomping at the bit here. So people who have a way to... You know, even a friend or a son or a daughter or a niece or a nephew, knowing someone at a college who's sensitive to this stuff, helping them get a Young Greens Rising chapter set up on a campus. As I mentioned, the phone banking is another way. Letter writing will be helping to provide materials and supports and the phone numbers and the phone script. You know, we train people in how to do phone banking. This is basically the 101 of how to run a campaign. And in the process here, this isn't something that, you know, is going to come to an end. For those who want to keep on the fight, because you know, we will get as far as we possibly can in this race. If we can win it, that's great, but if we don't win it, we're laying the groundwork for the next win. And for people to challenge power based on these principles in local races as well. So this is a process of developing a local structure, too. So there are many spin-offs here for empowering ourselves to be a politics of, by, and for the people that we otherwise don't have. This is to help us get jump-started and do that. And you can do that simply by going to our website and signing up to volunteer. We are going to be launching in the next week a petition drive as well based on our website. And this is a petition that we want to get everybody to spread far and wide to open up the debates. In the next month, the commission that controls the debates, they say they're issuing new rules. So we want them to hear from us right now about opening up the debate to more voices and more choices, as we discussed earlier in the program. So those are
great.
Two things that, two ways that you could plug in right now. One is a simple way, just signing a petition to open up the debates. But the other one is a way for you to connect with the campaign and with the organizing around the campaign. Does that make sense to you, Charles?
Yes, I really appreciate Green Party 101. It's a great description, and thank you so much for
great.
What you're doing.
Okay,
there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Charles. I'm going to clear the line because I think we have another another caller coming in. So
great.
So we'll get that on the line. And we're on the line with Dr. Jill Stein. And okay. And I think we have our caller on. Caller, you're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
My name's Teresa, and I work in Kansas City. And Dr. Stein, thank you for being such a viable candidate.
Well, thank you, Teresa, and thank you for calling in.
I wanted to say to the listeners, the Green Party, the National Green Party's website is gp.org, and it has links to each state a person might be in, telling about Green Party activity in each state.
That's great.
Great.
That's great. Good information.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you, Teresa. And you're in Kansas City. Okay, that's wonderful. And it is, you know, it's really great to connect to your local Green Party. And we very much hope, you know, in the course of this campaign, to get people connected to their parties, their state parties, and then to set up local chapters too, and to help people get familiar with how do you participate in this political process, because the big parties controlled by corporate money make it difficult for us. They make it as difficult as they can to be legitimate candidates. And I must say the Green Party is sort of the one survivor of people-powered politics. There used to be lots of national parties, and they kind of got wiped out by this fear campaign against the so-called spoilers who stand up for everyday people. They have really tried to besmirch us and do a smear campaign against independent politics, and you see what we have to show for it, you know, this government that throws us under the bus and political parties that throw us under the bus and serve their 1% or bankster masters. So there are very few political parties that have survived this negative propaganda and the rulemaking that they have inflicted on us. So what we try to do in the Green Party is give people support locally so that you don't have to go back to base one and figure out how you deal with all these oppressive rules. We're trying to do that at the national level and help the state parties do it and liberate candidates and activists to be, you know, to do exactly what it is that we must do in our communities, to fight our battles for housing, for jobs, for maintaining our schools and stop them from being privatized and being closed. You know, these are the kinds of battles that we want to be focused on, and we are a people-friendly party. And I really encourage people to get involved with the parties and also get involved in the campaign, because the parties don't exist everywhere right now, but the campaign is, you know, we're a national campaign, so we are equipped to organize people, to provide resources, and help you get plugged in wherever you are.
Well, we just have like another minute left, and so I want to thank you, Dr. Stein, for spending the hour with us, and it gone by so quickly. And
it sure did. Yes, and thank you so much, Mike. It's been great talking with you, and thank you to the callers and the listeners, and I encourage people to go to Jill2016.com, and let's take our future back. It's in our hands. Let's stand up and make it so.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Stein. And do you want to give out that website one more time?
Okay. So that's Jill2016.com, or you can go to our Facebook page, which is just Dr. Jill Stein, and that's D-R for Dr., the abbreviation, and no period. So all one word, Dr. Jill Stein. That will take you to our Facebook page, too.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed spending this time with you, and good luck to you.
Likewise. Thanks so much. Take
all right.
care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to go out with a couple of pieces, radio news and something about Mumia Abu-Jamal, and stay tuned for My Place with Larry J.
Daily radio news update from Wave Farm Radio.
And this is Tom Rowe with the radio news about radio waves. Michelle Helms, professor emerita at University of Wisconsin-Madison, reports at the Antenna blog that the Radio Preservation Task Force, a unit of the Library of Congress's National Recording Preservation Board, holds its first national conference February 25th through 27th next year in Washington, D.C. Professor Patty Scannell of the University of Michigan and Sam Brilowski, former head of the Library of Congress's Recorded Sound Division, are among the keynote speakers. The National Recording Preservation Board began in 2014 coordinating, quote, a nationwide effort to identify major collections of radio recordings and other materials that will help to raise cultural awareness of America's rich tradition of radio-based sound work and make it accessible to future generations, unquote. The group now includes more than 130 media studies scholars and over 350 affiliate archives, collections, and radio producing organizations across the U.S. and Canada. NPR, the Pacifica Radio Archives, the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, the Association for Cultural Equity, and the Alan Lomax Archive, the Paley Center for Media, the Prometheus Radio Project, the Media Ecology Project, the Studs Terkel Archive, and the Third Coast International Audio Fest are among the involved. This is Tom Rowe for Wave Farm Radio and WGXC.
Free Mumia, from the hands of the down presa.
This is Lynn Stewart. The life of brilliant journalist, intellectual, and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal is in great danger. On March 30th, Mumia went into diabetic shock and was hospitalized with life-threatening high blood sugar. Just 2 days later, he was transferred back to the same prison that failed to diagnose or treat him. His diet is dangerous and his health is deteriorating. Only massive pressure will stop his execution through malpractice. Call Pennsylvania Corrections Secretary John Wetzel at 717-728-4109. Demand that Mumia be allowed treatment by specialists of his choosing, the proper diabetic diet, and daily visits by family, friends, and attorneys. For more, go to bringmumiahome.com.
You're listening to